a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Okay, call to order on Senate Commerce and Energy Committee. Remind myself to turn off my own phone. Let that be your warning for everyone here. A little out of order, but please turn off your cell phones or at least turn off your ringers. Want to greet everyone listening on the Internet. I think we actually do have one out there today listening. I'd like to welcome everyone who's here and listening over the Internet. And we have a page here. Would you please come up and tell us your name, where you might be going to school, and how was the drive-in?
My name is Savannah Anderson. I go to school in Timberlake, and I plan to go to Oklahoma University. And my drive-in was all right. The roads were fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, Secretary, please call the roll.
Wadolka?
Here.
Buell?
Here.
Jensen?
Here.
Johnston?
Here.
Maher?
Here.
Lederman?
Here.
Pauline?
Here. Everyone
is present.
There's a quorum present. With that, the chair will entertain a motion to approve the minutes from last meeting. Moved by Senator Johnston, seconded by Senator Buell. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carried. Want to remind everyone to please sign in before you testify. And with that, we will go to order. House Bill 1097, an act to revise certain provisions relating to an employer's denial of workers' compensation claims. Any proponent testimony?
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commerce Committee, Senator Tim Rabe, District 25, most of Minnehaha County geographically. The first bill before you today is Senate Bill 1097. Basically what this bill attempts to do is remedy a situation which we currently have when a worker is injured on the job, or supposedly injured on the job, to be more correct. Right now, a battle goes on, as I suppose suspect it does in many insurance cases, of who's going to ultimately pay. And the issue we're talking about today is between work comp and the health carrier. And so the health care provider is thus left basically hanging in limbo until the two sides decide who ultimately is responsible for payment. Maybe work comp, maybe determined after investigation it wasn't on-the-job injury, work comp should pay. They will ultimately pay. What this bill attempts to correct is people hanging with no payment. And it simply states that the health carrier will pay the bill, so the person's health insurance will pay the bill. Later, if it's determined that that is not the case, that it was a work-related injury, work comp will reimburse the health care provider or the health carrier. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand down, let an expert to the topic speak to it more in depth before I screw it up, and I'll stand by for letting them answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any further proponent testimony?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Barnett, representing the State Bar. This 1097 comes from our work comp committee, which consists of both plaintiff lawyers for the workers and also defense lawyers who represent the work comp carriers. And both sides acknowledge that the situation described by Senator Rave exists and it occurs far too often. Typically, if you are sick or injured, let's say at home, your health carrier is going to cover and pay the bills for the doctors, the clinics, the hospitals, generally within 60 days. Work comp, however, if somebody is a piece of equipment falls on them on the job site, there's no question that it's going to be a work comp coverage in injury. What happens more frequently, though, is if it's a soft tissue issue, a question arises whether or not it was last night's basketball game or softball game versus picking up a box this morning at work. And so the work comp carrier has the opportunity to deny coverage until they have an independent medical exam and make that determination of whether or not it's a work-related injury. That can take 6 months, 9 months, and even longer. In the meantime, all the doctors and clinics and hospitals don't get paid, and the injured employee knows that he's covered by one company or the other, but their credit rating is being harmed. This attempts to simply say that if there's a dispute, the health carrier will cover, subject to reimbursement from the work comp carrier if, in fact, it's determined ultimately to be work-related. The concept is what we often call, and this committee certainly is familiar with it, which is subrogation. So if the health carrier pays, if it's work-related, their payments are subrogated and the work comp will reimburse them, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further proponent testimony?
Morning, Chairman Helene, members of the committee. My name is James Marsh. I'm the director of the Division of Labor and Management in the State Labor and Regulation Department. DLR supports House Bill 1097 and encourages you to support it. Thank you for your time. I'll remain available for questions.
Thank you very much. Any further proponent testimony?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, David Owen, South Dakota Chamber of Commerce and Industry. This is one section of a bill that became quite controversial, but this section never was. And so because we had a lot of discussions on the original version, this one came out of it. This is a good concept, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Any further proponents? Any further proponents? Hearing none, I'll ask for opponent testimony. Any opponents? Hearing none, we'll close testimony and open it up for questions from the committee. Senator Buell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably best question for Mr. Barnett. Mr. Barnett, I get the concept of the bill, and what I'm curious about is the logistics of how this would affect disability payments. It's my understanding that most disability cannot pay if work comp does pay on the job injury claim. My question is, if in the ensuing process of the investigation of whether it's on the job or off the job in the soft tissue scenario you described, what happens if disability pays a worker if they're out of work for X number of days or weeks or whatever, and it didn't pay initially, and then goes back, and it was discovered that it was on the job, and it does pay. And so then they've gotten double compensation for that injury. Does that make sense?
I'm not, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, would you like to rephrase the question?
I'll do my best.
Okay.
I'll elaborate. I work for a company. I work for Aflac, and we cannot pay on disability claims if work comp also paid. It's my understanding that that's federal law. And so my curiosity is this. If my company were to pay a disability claim because work comp did not pay, and then they later go back and pay because it was found to be an on-the-job injury, do you have any idea how this might affect the logistics of that?
Sure. I'll try, Senator. I think what controls is the insurance contract which you have sold. If there's a specific provision in the statutes, I don't know. Maybe perhaps Mr. Marsh would know. But my gut on that particular issue is that your contract controls, and whether or not you're insured has a legal obligation, a contractual obligation to reimburse Aflac, that I don't know.
Mr. Marsh, do you have an answer for that?
It wouldn't be any different from Mr. Barnett's. No, it would depend on the contract
language. Okay. For those listening, he says basically ditto the previous answer. Any follow-up on that, Senator?
No, thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Johnston.
You
could have at least gotten him out of his chair.
Mr. Barnett.
Senator Johnston.
Mr. Barnett. Mr. Chair, Mr. Barnett, you mentioned the fact that an evaluation would be needed to be done by an independent third party, if you will, to determine the injuries. Could you talk through that a little bit? Because that seems a little awkward to me.
Okay. May I respond, Mr. Chairman? Thank you for the question, Senator. When a person applies for work comp coverage, they're going to be required under the statute to release their medical records from their own physician. The insurance carrier that's covering work comp has a statutory right to require an independent medical exam. In other words, they are not bound to rely on the worker's doctor solely. They can require an independent. And that independent evaluation, should they request it, may take some considerable time to get it scheduled and conducted and reported back. And that lag time between the doctor that is treating them right on the spot versus an independent can be a considerable amount of time, and we're just trying to close that up.
Granted.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Barnett, I mean, is it conceivable that we could have a physician here seeing a patient in Peer, but have an independent third party from the carrier from Massachusetts?
Sure. Not under existing law, because the work comp law requires that the independent medical examiner be licensed in the state of South Dakota. So if I can follow up, the injury may have occurred in Peer. The insurance comp carrier may require that injured employee travel to Sioux Falls, to Sanford, or Rapid City Regional for the independent medical exam, and they are reimbursed for that expense of having to travel for the independent, but they cannot require them to go out of state for the independent.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we'll open it up for discussion and or action. Senator Bagalka.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
I move do pass.
Motion of do pass moved by Senator Bagalka. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Senator Buell. Any comments on that? Any discussion? With that, all those in favor will say aye. Opposed, nay. Secretary, please call the roll.
Bagalka.
Aye.
Buell.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Johnston.
Aye.
Maher.
Aye.
Lederman.
Aye.
Holine.
Aye.
It is unanimous.
It is unanimous. Senate Bill 1097, receiving a favorable motion, will move down to the floor with a do-pass motion. Senator Johnston?
Mr. Chair, would you entertain a motion?
I would entertain that motion. Motion is move consent by Senator Johnston. Is there a second?
Yes.
Seconded by Senator Bagalka, was it? Okay, Senator Bagalka. This is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? 1097 is placed on the consent calendar. Congratulations. With that, the committee will now move on to House Bill 1106, an act to revise certain limited liability company statutes. Senator Rave.
God bless you, Senator Johnston. I will not forget you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Rave, State Senator, District 25. As soon as technology catches up, I'll begin. Ladies and gentlemen, House Bill 1106 comes from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, also known as the Uniform Laws Commission. House Bill 1106 is the Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. This revision was drafted several years ago and has been under review by the State Bar. This legislature, in cooperation with the State Bar, has worked to develop a positive business environment in South Dakota, promote economic development, and stay at the cutting edge of business law. House Bill 1106 does precisely that. I know Mr. Barnett will follow me with further explanation. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that if I could at least hand out and we could discuss briefly, and you can take action later. It's a fairly simple amendment, so with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll just start discussing it. The amendment is to clean up some ambiguous language related to requirements for qualification of foreign entities. While the LLC statute permits qualification of a foreign entity, it does not specify that an entity must register before it does business in our state. Compare this to the corporate statute. A foreign corporation may not transact business in this state until it obtains a certificate of authority from the Office of Secretary of State. I would ask you to consider this amendment that would specify that no foreign LLC could do business in South Dakota without first registering with the Secretary of State's office. While the concept is implied in the current statute, is not clear. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stand down, let Mr. Barnett further explain the bill, and stand by for hopefully no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further proponent testimony?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tom Barnett, representing the State Bar. I'd like to give the committee a little brief history on LLCs. The first one, the first limited liability company statute was adopted in Wyoming in 1977, and the public policy behind it was an attempt to simplify the entity that a business would operate under, but avoid the necessity of having to go subchapter S with all the complexities there. So the concept of an LLC was developed and enacted. The other states didn't follow suit with LLCs until the IRS ruled that, in fact, the LLC would receive the same tax treatment that we generally refer to as subchapter S's. After that IRS ruling came down, there was great or substantial interest around the country to enact similar laws. The State Bar worked in 1991 and 92 to develop the LLC body of law, which was enacted by this legislature in 1993 in Chapter 34. A few years later, actually in 1996, the Uniform Laws Commission drafted uniform language so that all the states could have some uniform language to rely upon and go forward. We have revised, this legislature has made a number of revisions over the years, and we do so because there's been litigation, and so we try to address ambiguities that may exist in the law so we can avoid future litigation. And what 1106 does, and I'm just going to hit the highlights, The primary revisions involve the issues of formation, the relationships between members of the LLC and managers, if they happen to have a manager, and particularly, you'll notice in the later stages of the bill, it spends considerable time on mergers, conversions, and foreign limited liability companies, and what the Uniform Laws Commission determined, and that was also similarly determined by our Business Law Committee, was that we didn't have a good enough roadmap to tell people on how to easily and properly conduct mergers, how to easily invite out of state or foreign. By foreign, we're not talking about France or anything. Foreign corporations or foreign LLCs are from the other 49 states or the Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, American Virgin Islands. And so this revision is an attempt to make it easier for those companies to either merge or to move their businesses in to South Dakota. We've clarified the definition of contributions, operating agreements. You'll notice under definitions, we changed the definition of sign to facilitate and recognize the fact that we now have electronic signatures recognized both by state law and federal law. Section 901 is what, as I referred to, was the merger, conversion, and domestication. Finally, new provisions were added because on occasion, and if you know corporate law, and I understand that there aren't any lawyers in the Senate other than the honorary lawyer, Senator Rave, on occasion corporations and their shareholders get involved in what we call derivative litigation. It's similar to from law school days, 10b-5, which are regular corporations. Recognizing that occasionally that can happen in LLCs, the existing statute was silent on how does an LLC handle that, where you've got some members that are involved in the litigation, or the LLC gets pulled into litigation, and so we address that issue. It's a uniform law. The most important thing that we've retained in our own law that isn't in the uniform law is the special statutes that we have with regard to trusts. South Dakota has cutting-edge trust laws. A number of years ago, we came to this legislature and said trusts ought to be allowed to be members of LLCs, and this body agreed with that. We've maintained that special language and special trust statute that was not included in the uniform law, and that's because we are at the cutting edge and we're actually ahead of the Uniform Laws Commission. I will draw your attention that there was an amendment on the House floor. The Secretary of State's office was concerned because as part of the rewrite of the revision, there were some existing sections of the code that were overstruck, and one of the things that was overstruck was one paragraph that talked about electronic filing with the Secretary of State's office, and they wanted that back in. The problem with removing the overstrikes is that it doesn't belong in that position anymore. And so Representative Lust and I worked together, and we suggested to the Secretary of State that what we ought to do, because there's all kinds of filings in this revision, that we ought to go all the way to the last chapter in under miscellaneous and say that you can file electronically any document that is permitted by the Secretary of State to do so. So rather than have that electronic filing appear 10 times in the code, we do it all the way at the end and apply it to the whole chapter. And the Secretary of State's office was happy with that amendment. I can tell you that on the amendment that was just offered or just mentioned by Senator Rave, we're cool with that amendment too. I don't know how much ambiguity there is out there, but if there are enough people concerned, let's fix it. This answers the question, and I'll stand by for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further proponents? Any further proponents? Hearing none, we'll ask for opponent testimony on House Bill 1106. Any opponents? Seeing none, we will close testimony and open it up for questions from the committee. Any questions? It's feeling like a Monday morning here. So, Senator Johnston.
Mr. Burnett. And I apologize, Mr. Chair, if I missed something when I had to step out briefly. So, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barnett, last year in Senate State Affairs, we had a package of bills which modernized our business laws in regards to domicile. They were then put on the ballot, and a couple of them, I think they all failed, if I'm not mistaken, on the ballot. Does any of those things that we did last year, are those addressed in this reform measure that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Senator. The answer is no. We don't. This has nothing to do with the actions that were put on the ballot last year, which, to my knowledge, was all restricted to corporations. And the problem with the corporations is that we have a provision from the late 1890s with regard to corporations. That constitutional restriction does not exist and apply to LLCs, so nothing we're doing in 1106 has anything to do with what the Senate considered last year.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, we'll open it up for discussion and or action from the committee. Oh, yes, and I do want to remind the committee that we do have an amendment, Amendment 1106 J.E., I would entertain a motion to move the amendment. Moved by Senator Johnston, seconded by Senator Maher. Any discussion on that? This is just a voice vote, isn't it? So with voice vote on the amendment, all those in favor of 1106 J.E., please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? House Bill 1106 is thereby amended. With that, we'll move on to House Bill 1106 as amended. Discussion and or action. Senator Johnston, you're my hero.
I move due pass.
Motion of due pass moved by Senator Johnston, seconded by Senator Lederman. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, Secretary will please call the roll. All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed, nay.
Legalka?
Aye.
Buell?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Johnston?
Aye.
Maher?
Aye.
Lederman?
Aye.
Colleen?
Aye.
It is unanimous.
House Bill 1106, receiving a unanimous motion, will move down to the floor with a due pass motion. Senator Johnston.
Mr. Chair, I move consent.
Move consent by Senator Johnston. Is there a second? Seconded by Senator Lederman. This is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye. Any discussion on that?
No.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? House Bill 1106 is placed on consent.
Old Johnston Hughes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Whatever bill you need, Senator.
I wanted to hear you talk to
you. No, you don't.
We need to save the paper.
With that, we'll move on to House Bill 1125, an act to allow perpetual care and maintenance guarantee funds for cemeteries to be administered by cemetery corporations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnston.
As a reminder, we have an individual that would like to testify on this via telephone, and Amanda has his contact information at the appropriate time.
And Representative Hoffman, I am reading these bills correct, that these are kind of in tandem.
They are, sir.
The chair will grant some leniency. The person who wants to telephone in is an opponent to these two bills, and for the sake of continuity in the meeting, I'm going to allow him to testify on both bills at one time so we can ask questions. So I will grant you some leniency to do the same, but focus on 1125 first, and then if you want to mention 1127, but we will give you your own rebuttal for both bills and things like that.
Thank you very much. Charlie Hoffman, District 23 representative. District 23 lies next to District 3. And 1125 and 1127 comes to us. Basically, a little history has to go in. Speaking on 1125, what happened last year was we brought a bill to do this exact same thing. It got amended in the Senate to say that a perpetual funeral home owner could only take 6% of the interest and 6% of the principal, basically would be putting them out of business. I believe that every perpetual care cemetery in the state this summer has been actually operating illegally. This permits them to actually start operating legally. Now, what it does is it says that if a member of the board, and in the House committee, we had the owner of Sunset Memorial Gardens, who sits on the board and is the he sits on that board, and he is also an owner of a number of funeral homes, not all of them associated with the Sunset. There's one in Eureka, Ellendale, Ashley. He's also the coroner. That's an elected position. What this bill does is if the board of directors of a perpetual care cemetery petitions the circuit court, they will, if agreed upon by the board, have a overseeing authority on that board to make sure that that trust, all these are to go back, perpetual care cemeteries, in all actuality, you pay a certain fee and you have your loved one buried and you walk away and there's never again a dollar that you put into that. So that integrity of that trust fund is really important. This would allow some of the interest that's not needed for maintaining that cemetery above that maintenance interest income to be used for long-term, one-time option payments for something like a lawnmower or a building, or in the case of Sunset Memorial in Aberdeen, because it was always flooded, they built a berm and a dam and a water causeway around it. What the connection is that this fund has to be maintained, and 1127 maintains that only good actors will be able to follow through with this. It permeates through any person that's a bad actor and wants to spend that trust fund down to a non-operating interest-bearing fund. So when you look at 1127, if the fund has accumulated a principal amount which has earned sufficient income for each of the three prior calendar years, then and only then can they use some of that income for the maintenance or one-time fixes on that. Basically, what this does is it fixes a bill from last year, and I do believe that it's written correctly. It came out of our House and Senate with nary a vote against it. One vote, I believe, on the House floor. It was on consent. I'll stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further proponent testimony on 1125? Hearing none, we will be at ease for just a moment while we get Mr. Phil Schmitz on the telephone. The committee is at ease for just a moment.
Phil, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Perfect.
Can you hear me?
Just stand by.
Okay, thank you. Phil, can you hear us? I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Stand by.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
That was strange. We're getting double, or we're getting feedback.
You know what? I'm going to shut mine off because I was listening in on you guys.
Oh, that's what it was. Yes, thank you.
I'm just going to shut that off completely. So, all right. So it's just, I was just weighing in to see where you guys were. So.
All right, let's try one more time. Good. No feedback. Thank you.
Yes.
We are still at ease. Phil, the chair just stepped out for a moment, so stand by.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, on the line we have Phil Schmitz. Mr. Schmitz, would you please identify yourself, say where you live, and who you are representing today, and the chair is going to grant you leniency to testify against both bills, if you would like.
Thank you. Yes, I would. My name is Phil Schmitz. I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I live in District 14, officially, I guess, and I'm representing myself today. I also am just a little history on what I do for a living. I'm a third-generation funeral director. I manage George Boom Funeral Home in Sioux Falls and Brandon, South Dakota, and I'm a partner in those operations. And 10 years ago, I became the manager and president of Hills Rest Memorial Park Cemetery in Sioux Falls. It's a 88-acre memorial park cemetery. With a mausoleum and a cremation garden. We serve about 300 families a year there with interment needs. And so that's kind of a little bit of my background. I'm a member of the International Cemetery and Cremation Organization, which is a national and international organization. I do not belong to the South Dakota Funeral Director Association at the current time. I wanted to speak, which is probably one of the reasons why I didn't hear about House Bill 1125 and 27 before they had passed. I kind of found out about them on the 11th hour, but I felt I needed to speak to them. In the last 10 years at Hills of Rest, one of my responsibilities is also as trustee of the Perpetual Care and Maintenance Fund of the cemetery. And Hills of Rest has gone through, since its inception in 1933, has gone through about five different ownership changes. And the last one was the cemetery's management contract was owned by a company equally out of Minnesota and one out of Kansas. And basically, what they did was within the scope of the law, but they basically put nothing back into the cemetery. And so it became a sad, it was becoming a dilapidated cemetery, where in previous ownership had kept it in a great state of repair. And so the opportunity came to purchase that management contract. And so our firm did so. And I didn't really know much about running a cemetery because I'd just been going to one for my 32-year career in funeral service. But I've learned a lot since that time. And the main thing that I've learned is that, you know, when people purchase their grave space or interment space or their interment right in a perpetual care cemetery, they pay that perpetual care fee. And so if a grave costs, like it does in our cemetery, you know, roughly there's varying prices, but let's just say it costs $1,000. We're required by law to put 10% of that away. And we do so into that permanent care and maintenance fund. What we decided to do a number of years ago, 2 years ago, was because interest rates were so low, we decided as a board to increase that by 50%. So we take $150 out of a $1,000 interment space and we put that aside. Families that bought their graves in 1933, 1943, 1973, whatever, doesn't make any difference. They got that assurance that when they bought it, that money was going to get put aside and that only the earnings, if any, would be used and that the principal would never be touched. I don't think that's broke. I think that cemeteries have run into problems because of a number of things. Number one, things cost more expensive today than they did a few years ago. Grave spaces were sold for very small amounts of money. I mean, you could buy, back in the 30s, you could buy, you know, 10 graves for, you know, $150. And so very small amounts of money were put in that. What's happened since is, you know, we've had this terrible, interest climate where funds have not, you know, grown dramatically. But I don't think we should change a law that clearly hasn't been broken in one sense. And I think that once you spend principal is gone. You know, whether we make a circuit court in charge of looking over our shoulder for 3 years, you know, I would contend that there's not many people in that room or in this town that could look at the finances of a cemetery and say, well, I really understand how that works. So to ask a legal entity to overlook things, you know, they may not know what they're looking at. A lot of these rural cemeteries, at least around the Sioux Falls and Brandon area, that are either church-based or they're just, most of them are church-based, they've started to have to add additional fees at the time of because they didn't put any money aside because they weren't required to. Some of them did, some of them didn't, and so I get requests periodically, you know, what do you think we should do? We don't have enough money in our care fund to buy gas for the lawnmowers or to pay somebody to do that. And again, those aren't perpetual care cemeteries, but that's the kind of problem that can exist. I think that, you know, to the senator's statement about, you know, bad actors, you know, 3 years, I don't know if that's a long enough period of time. The cemetery that I operate and oversee, you know, has had a series of people through it. And about 5 years ago, we set up an additional fund at the Sioux Falls Area Foundation for people that wanted to donate for the long-term care and maintenance of the cemetery. We have, for example, a bell tower in the middle of the cemetery that was used in the 30s to play music. Actually, people came out and had picnics in the cemetery. I have pictures of it in our office. And, well, you know, that structure is about 30 feet tall, and it's made out of brick. Well, you know, it needs maintenance, and it needs care, and it's very expensive to do that. And so we didn't feel that putting money donations into the other fund the way it currently stands under current status was really safe enough. And so we put a stronger lockbox into effect so that people can donate money and put in the restrictions on the fund down there, so that, you know, only a certain percentage of the earnings can ever be drawn out of that. Is that short-sighted? I don't know. I just know that an 88-acre cemetery like we have to operate, you know, costs a lot of money to do. The other thing I know is that families in South Dakota are choosing cremation at a higher rate than what they previously did. My own personal experience at the firms that I'm associated with, about currently last year in 2012, 42% of the families that we helped serve chose cremation for a final form of disposition. Now, what happens with the cremated body afterwards? About half of those people in this area will inter them, okay? And by inter, I mean they'll either place in the ground in a family lot, they will put them in a columbarium in a cemetery, but basically they're going to a cemetery. So what does that mean? That means half aren't doing that. So what are they doing? Well, once we release them to a family member, unless they've told us about that they're going to scatter, we don't know what happens to them, but we know they aren't getting buried. So if they aren't getting buried, they aren't buying cemetery lots. And if they aren't buying cemetery lots, they're not, you know, there's no income coming into the cemetery. And so fully a third of the 300 burials that we have or interments at Hills Arrest are cremation at this point. That number, I have no doubt, is going to continue to increase. And so I guess my point in telling you that is that we shouldn't be putting less money into a perpetual care and maintenance fund. We should be putting more into it, because here's 88 acres in the middle of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that looks like a park, and it's very well maintained. What's it going to look like, you know, after I'm buried out there on the lot? I mean, I own my own cemetery space there, too, and I want it to look as nice as it does, well, on a spring day, not necessarily today, but it's a guarantee that we gave people in the past, and I really feel that these two bills could have unintended long-term consequences. There is no federal watchdog. The Federal Trade Commission is the watchdog over the entire United States as far as funeral service and a funeral home is concerned. But there is no federal watchdog over cemeteries. I mean, there's been some attempts to do it, and, you know, as a businessman, I don't like more regulation, but if you've turned your TV on at all, you've seen what's happened in Chicago with people double selling of graves. I mean, and that is not, you know, there's much more. I get a little publication that tells me all the bad acts that different cemeteries and funeral homes do across the country every year. And it's amazing to me how many stupid people there are. But without having a federal watchdog, I believe that it's our state legislators' responsibility to provide that. You know, we're not taxpayer subsidized. I don't, you know, the only taxpayer subsidized cemetery in the state that I'm aware of is the federal cemetery out in the Black Hills, and that's of course federal. But anyway, we're all taxpayers. We all pay into that system too.
Mr. Schmitz?
Yes.
Could I ask you to please wind up your testimony now? I believe we've gotten a very good response from you, and just for the sake of time, I'd just ask for you to wind it up and so that we can move on to questions.
Very good. That's all I have, Senator.
Okay. Thank you very much. Could you please stay on the line for just a moment?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to allow Representative Hoffman a rebuttal. This is a pretty good debate, actually. For the students who just walked in, we are talking about cemeteries. And the maintenance of cemeteries is done by a trust to take care of the grounds, you know, so that they can always be mowed and flowers taken care of and things like that. And we're trying to Representative Hoffman here is trying to revise that. And the question is do you allow it to spend some of the principal on the money that they have? So, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie Hoffman, District 23. I'll go through the rebuttal in order as I listen to the opponent testimony. The poor maintenance of a perpetual care cemetery may very well be because of a low operating budget needed for those one-time fixes. The reasons for improvement at any perpetual care cemetery garners a guarantee of more business, hopefully. The percent interest must be adequate for passage of this. If the trust fund isn't making enough interest, this bill doesn't allow you to take any money out. Now, there was no opposition from the Funeral Home Association. The three-year minimum that a judicial review has to be in place has to be petitioned, and you have to prove that you are, well, a good actor and be able to maintain that, or the judicial review that is currently under 3 years won't be allowed to you. The opponent stated that cremations will increase. I'll state that's a 100% subjective statement. Cremations just as likely could decrease. We don't know that. Anyway, at the end of this, a long-term management with these two bills, in my mind, and with the person who I'm sponsoring these for, will definitely help their survivability in the future, no matter what happens with burial rates, funerals, cemeteries, or cremations. I'll ask you to pass this for all the right reasons. I'll certainly stand by for questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Hoffman. While we have Mr. Schmitz on the line, well, first off, where are you all from? Timberlake. So, high school class, or are you aware of our page here? She's only seriously messed up twice, so really, it could be worse.
I don't think they've ever seen her before.
Okay. I would ask the committee to, let's see if we can ask our questions to Mr. Schmitz first and possibly save him some time on the phone. With that, we'll open it up for questions from the committee. Senator Jensen.
Question from Mr. Schmidt. Sir, what is your response to the rebuttal? I'm just curious. I want to continue the dialogue on this.
Sure. Well, that's fine. I can only take a look at the history, you know, when we, you know, we can guess, yeah, cremation's not going to increase. You know, you can take a look at Sturgis, South Dakota, where the cremation rate is about 85%. And 20 years ago, it was, probably around 10%. Within my own company, since I've been here in 1985, when I came here, the cremation rate was 2%. My cremation rate last year was 52%. If you wanted to, and I didn't spend the time looking at the Cremation Association of North America, CANA is the official organization that tracks all the cremations in this country, and they have predicted low every time that they've reported. We can argue the nuance of whether cremation is going to increase or not. I can only say that in my own personal experience, it has dramatically. At the cemetery, the cremation rate, people choosing cremation disposition has increased dramatically. The perpetual care and maintenance guarantee fund is to take care of the general maintenance of the cemetery. You know, improvements is entirely another matter whatsoever, I think. If I need to put a new road in, to a specific area, or I need to put in a section of the cemetery that I want to sell things to, well, that's a capital improvement, okay? That's a little bit different than care and maintenance. Care and maintenance means, to me and to our board and our trustees, means taking care of what you do have. If I had something that I wanted to make better at the cemetery that wasn't there in the past, well, again, that's a capital improvement. That's not a that's not taking care of what's there. That's mowing the lawn, making sure the road is passable. That's trimming around the markers. That's trimming trees, things of that nature. And I still submit that, you know, 3 years is, a cemetery is forever, okay? It's forever. You know, we typically don't move cemeteries. And so they're going to be there a long, long time. And once they either stop being used or fill up, the money needs to be there. You cut into principal. You spend principal. I don't care what business you're in. It's gone. You never get it back. So I don't know if that addressed everything. I wasn't writing them down, but that's my personal thing. And here's the thing, too, about it is that, you know, one of my staff said, well, what do we care if this passes? We'll keep doing what we're doing. I said, well, what's the long-term consequence? So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schmitz. Just as a side note, I know cemeteries don't get moved, but it's one thing I've learned watching bad horror movies is they always have a housing complex built over them eventually so that the ghosts live. Mr. Schmitz, well, first I'll open it up for questions from any other committee member. The chair has a question for you, Mr. Schmitz. I think Representative Hoffman made a good point. I understand the concern of the bill is whenever you dip into the principal, because I've been hearing bills similar to this over the last couple of years at local government, and dipping into the principal does get to be a dangerous matter. However, Representative Hoffman in 1127 does at least address it to, you know, address my concerns on that, where it says, first off, you have to be making money for 3 straight years. And then he made what I think is a pretty good argument that says if you're going to make a capital improvement, it's probably going to, I hate to use the term, attract more business when you're talking about a funeral, a cemetery, but I think that that's a pretty cogent point. Would you care to address that?
Sure, but who's responsible for that? What about all these people that have, in the past, you know, put money into it, okay? You know, times change, and I understand different people's you know, what they want to choose for their ultimate form of disposition has been changing. But we don't think that you can take the money out of, nor should you take the money out of a perpetual care and maintenance fund to add improvements to it. Yeah, it might draw more people to it, but I think you need to think of more creative ways. I mean, we got very creative financing with different, with some monument companies, and, cremationist, providers out of Cold Spring, Minnesota, where they gave us zero interest and long extended terms to put improvements into the cremation section of our garden so that we built it, okay? We built it with their help, okay? And then in turn, that was an improvement to the cemetery. None of the money came out of the perpetual care. And guess what happened? People saw that, and they started buying it. Okay, and so it paid for itself. I'm doing the same project right now inside our mausoleum. Again, created no-interest financing through the manufacturer of new glass-fronted niches. Okay, and, you know, you talk about Sunset Memorial. I've been to Sunset Memorial many times. And their mausoleum was built by a company that's now bankrupt that built my mausoleum. Okay, so I'm very familiar with the structure and so forth. And they have exactly the same kind of glass-fronted niches inside their building as I have in mine because they were built at exactly the same time. And, you know, I don't know what their deal was, but that's what I negotiated with the same vendor. So, again, here's two instances, our cremation garden exterior. And you can look at our place at hillsofrest.com. You can see all those kinds of things if you're interested. And basically, those things were built with little or no money down and zero interest, and they took care of themselves. So I just think that you have to get creative in ways other than taking principal out of a permanent care fund to improve your cemetery, you know.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Schmitz. Any further questions from the committee? Senator Bogalka.
I've got one for Representative Hoffman.
Okay, do we have... actually, Mr. Schmitz, just please stay on the line. We might have a further question for you.
Now, So Representative Hoffman, you referred to last year's bill about this 6%. Now, that section of law is not in either of these two bills, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, Senator Vogalka.
As I remember the debate on that bill last year, I believe it was clarified that it was 6% of what was available that year. In other words, we weren't touching 94%. And that was the same every year, so we still always left 94% in there. So I guess I don't understand how this is so terrible.
Mr. Chairman, the bill last year also had an amendment from Senator Northrup that said you can only take 6% of the principal and 6% of the interest from the trust. The amount of money in this that has to be left is enough trust of the amount to further the operating expenses for the next year. You can't draw down the principal from creating enough interest so that you can't run this the next year. That's the judicial review. And going a step further, I don't think anyone would ever petition the court to draw down a trust fund so far that you wouldn't have enough interest to maintain your operating budget for the next year. They won't be able to do that. Nor will, if you attempt that, will the judicial review ever give you an opportunity to run that independently from that overview, I believe. I hope I answered your question, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Schmidt.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on what you just heard? I'm still undecided on this. Thank you.
Well, none of us have a crystal ball. And I just go back to what is in the best interest of the lot owner of the cemetery. You know, what is always in the best interest of that consumer? And, it becomes a slippery slope, in my opinion. And, I don't take principle out of anything. If we need to raise, additional funds, and maybe Sunset does things differently than we do. You know, it's pay as you go. And if it costs more to dig a grave and to have people to do that, then I'm going to have to raise the opening and closing of the grave fee. Now, those things vary greatly in our state, but here in Sioux Falls, the digging of a grave is around $1,000. Now, does it physically actually cost $1,000 to dig a grave? Well, no, it doesn't. But it's a fee-based system. You know, you pay as you go, and that way, you know, we don't make a huge amount of profit at Hill's Arrest because you'll price yourself completely out of the market. But at the same time, you've got to pay as you go, and it's a user-based or fee-based system. And our funds have not been growing. I mean, you know, it's been 1-2%. Well, cripes all Friday, you know, that gives you very little into your operating budget for care and upkeep. And to then take principal out of that, you're going to go backwards fast. I don't get it. I mean, I've been a business operator.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schmitz. I believe that the question was answered.
Answered your question.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions? Any further questions? Hearing none, we'll thank you, Mr. Schmitz, for providing very good testimony and answering our questions. We thank you very much. You can hang up and continue to listen to us, and we'll open it up for discussion and our action by the committee. I was pointed out to me by Senator Lederman that this bill, or I think these bills in tandem in the House, received a total of a 4-minute testimony in committee, and we've beat that by quite a bit. But that's part of the process, is you have to go through two houses because you give people enough time to, in the case of Mr. Schmitz, be aware of a bill and come and testify. So we thank him for that. And with that, we are back to discussion and our action by the committee. Senator Lederman.
I move due pass.
Motion of due pass.
House Bill 1125.
Motion of due pass. We are on House Bill 1125 now. Motion of due pass moved by Senator Lederman, seconded by Senator Maher. Any discussion on that? All those in favor will say aye. Opposed, nay. Secretary, please call the roll.
Legalka?
Aye.
Buell?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Johnston?
Aye.
Maher?
Aye.
Lederman? Pauline?
Aye.
Unanimous.
Motion of due pass receives a unanimous vote by the committee. Senator Lederman? Move consent. You can't really do that when you have an opponent testimony, though. You can, but I guess we do have to vote on that, though, because it was moved. Is there a second? Motion fails for lack of a second. House Bill 1125 will move down to the Senate floor with a recommendation of due pass. We are now on House Bill 1127. Any discussion and or action by the committee? Looking for some help here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lederman.
Move due pass, House Bill 1127.
Thank you. Motion of due pass on House Bill 1127 moved by Senator Lederman, seconded by Senator Buell. Thank you. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Secretary, please call the roll.
Legalka?
Aye.
Buell?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Johnston?
No.
Maher?
Aye.
Lederman?
Aye.
Pauline?
Aye.
6-1.
Six in favor, one against. House Bill 1127 will move to the Senate floor with the recommendation of due pass. Thank you very much, committee. With that, that concludes our business for the day. For the class from Timber Lake, I think that they're talking alternative education over in the House Education Committee right now, which might be a little bit more interesting than gravesites. We'll leave that up to you. Senate Ag, in which case gravesites would be better than that. I don't know. But with that, we thank you for your attendance. Please leave your binders behind.
You all stayed awake.
Yeah, you all stayed awake, so thank you very much. With that, the chair will recommend it, will entertain a motion to adjourn. Moved by Senator Johnston, seconded by Senator Lederman. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.